Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Today, Governor Cuomo threatens to revoke National Grid's license over their leverage of natural gas hookups.
Then, we discuss U.S. sanctions in Bolivia with the co-chair of the anti-war coalition, Joe Lombardo.
And later on, Willie Terry interviews Native American Mark Tyack of the Piscataway Nation Singers and Dancers.
After that, a new episode of Collar Works Radio.
And finally, Albany Civic Theater is producing Alabama Story. And here are some headlines.
The Albany County Legislature voted Tuesday to adopt the state's 5-cent bag fee. The vote was 22 in favor and 14 against. State lawmakers earlier this year agreed to ban plastic bags as a way to promote reusable bags, but left it up to local governments to decide whether to require a fee for the paper bags. Without such a fee, environmentalists believe that many shoppers will just switch to paper bags rather than bringing their own bags. Albany is one of the first communities to adopt the paper bag fee. The city of Troy approved the fee earlier this summer.
The Times Union reports that Waterfleet and Troy are launching a $200,000 feasibility study to look at how to transform the Congress Street Bridge. Troy wants to integrate the bridge into a street network that would reopen River Street as a direct thoroughfare connecting downtown to the neighborhoods to the south along the Hudson River. Waterfleet wants to provide access from the bridge to Hudson Shores Park.
And supporters of Donald Trump protested at Glens Falls City Hall on Tuesday against a proposed law aimed at keeping competing protests at least 30 feet apart and move protesters away from the city's Centennial Circle and Civil War Monument. Six protesters called the proposed law unconstitutional because it would require them to file an application to the city 10 days prior to the demonstration. Trump supporters have been launching counter-protests against the local activists protesting the action of the president. The peace activists have complained about what they call the overly aggressive tactics of the Trump allies.
U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is proposing legislation that would put PFAS under control of the Federal Clean Water Act, requiring companies that use them to get permits. PFOA contamination led to a water crisis in Hoosick Falls 3 years ago that is still being cleaned up. The substances are associated with thyroid illnesses as well as cancers and immune disorders.
Local Republican state lawmakers, Senator Jim Tedesco and Assembly Member Mary Beth Walsh, are calling for the repeal or at least postponing of a recently enacted bail reform measures that they charge will put dangerous criminals back on the street and strain local law enforcement officers.
Governor Andrew Cuomo has threatened to repeal National Grid's license to operate downstate in 2 weeks if it fails to provide natural gas hookups to new customers. National Grid is using the halt in hookups to push for approval of the controversial Williams pipeline. Cuomo argues that National Grid has been incompetent in not developing alternate plans for its operations, including promoting the use of renewable heat systems like air heat pumps and geothermal. However, environmentalists are objecting to Cuomo, saying that, quote, gas can be trucked, shipped, or barged, unquote, as an alternative.
And for you that are just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM in Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM in Schenectady.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have a comment, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
On the eve of November's Public Service Commission meeting, Governor Cuomo's aggressive letter to National Grid may be a hint that the demand to address the climate crisis is gaining political momentum.
Public Service Commission meetings are often sleepy affairs, but that's not true right now. On October 14th, at the last PSC meeting, the Commission voted to approve an order previously issued by PSC Chair John Rhodes to show cause directed at the gas utility National Grid. National Grid had abruptly denied service to more than 1,100 customers, claiming that the state was constraining supplies by blocking the installation of massive new pipeline projects, especially the Williams Pipeline. On November 12th, Governor Cuomo raised the stakes still further when he sent a letter to National Grid giving the utility a 14-day notice of the state's intent to revoke National Grid's license to operate its downstate natural gas system. In other words, the current basis of the utility's existence. To start this segment, let's listen to an excerpt from Commissioner Tracy Edwards' statement at the October 14th PSC meeting.
I believe that this was an intentional, chaotic, confusion pipeline approval strategy that impacted their customers who depend on reliability. And that's where I come down on this. I went to their website to see what it is that they were telling customers. And it says, we cannot process applications for new and expanded gas service in Brooklyn, Queens, and Long Island until we receive state and federal approval for the NESE project. You may still submit in the meantime, and we remain cautiously optimistic that the NESE project will proceed on schedule and be in service by the winter of 2020-2021. There was no transparent communication. I do not think that we own this particular issue. I think it lies squarely with their chaotic and intentional confusing strategy. Yes, we absolutely, with all the things that I have seen, we have capacity issues. But what I want to know is how big are they? Where's the line in the sand? Is it this year? Is it next year? Where was the plan B? Because even if approved, we would still have issues today. I read, you know, sometimes you have to watch people when they don't think you're paying attention. So I went back to all of their annual reports. I read all their annual reports, all of them. And this was not mentioned. They identified top-down, bottom-up risk assessments. And when I asked why this was not included in there, what I received back is that while National Grid has included operational risk factors in its annual report to shareholders, we have not specifically addressed the current issue. Okay, so why not? I find that odd. If we have a customer in an apartment where the building provides heat and hot water, this is a real customer. This customer was denied service for residential non-heating for cooking purposes. The apartment had been had pre-existing non-heating customer. There was no new load, but they were denied. When that person called the PSC, they were then put back on. But what about the other people on the floor in that apartment building that do not know to call the PSC? They are not aware of it. What about them? What about the most vulnerable customers that have no idea about all of this? What about them? What about the renovations? You go and you put your hard-earned money to try to improve your home, and you think that you're going to have reliable service and you don't. What about the small business customers that have saved up to open up a business, to be entrepreneurs, and then they can't open up because they can't have any guests. This is beyond whether there's a capacity issue or not. This is absolutely unacceptable.
Now let's listen to Andrew Pizzullo of Food and Water Action, speaking at a press conference on October 14th for Renewable Heat Now, a coalition of groups advocating for immediate transition of New York onto renewable heat.
The science is crystal clear. We can't build any new fossil fuel projects in New York State if we hope to stay below 1.5 degrees warming, the threshold laid out in the Paris Climate Accords. We can't build any more power plants and pipelines, especially ones that transmit and burn methane-emitting fracked gas, if we want to stick to the benchmarks that are laid out in New York's new climate legislation. It's really that simple. And it should be the guiding principle for all of the Public Service Commission's work going forward. Coming out of that meeting today, there are certainly some commissioners, Commissioner Rhodes and others, who seem to be turning to the reality of that scientific fact. There are others who obviously are not. I wonder if it's a time that they maybe step aside and let others take over, because there's a lot of work to be done here in New York and nationally. Now, I applaud Governor Cuomo for rejecting the dangerous, dirty, and unnecessary Williams pipeline, and the Public Service Commission for standing up for New Yorkers as National Grid holds them hostage to what is a shameless, cynical, and fabricated gas shortage. Investor-owned utilities should not and cannot put their financial interests above New Yorkers' heat, and the Public Service Commission should fine, penalize, and even revoke the franchise of National Grid if they continue to fail to meet the needs of customers. Now, we hope Governor Cuomo and the Public Service Commission will do the same in the Hudson Valley, where I live and organize, by denying permits for the Danskammer fracked gas power plant in the frontline environmental justice community of Newburgh, and move quickly to decommission fracked gas power plants like CPV and Cricket Valley. We have fewer and fewer years left to completely decarbonize the New York State economy. We need to build thousands of megawatts of battery storage, thousands and thousands of megawatts of generating capacity of solar, wind, geothermal, and hydro. We need to weatherize, insulate, and put residential solar on thousands of buildings, businesses, homes, and schools. We need to improve and update our dated electrical grid infrastructure system. Those are transmission lines. We need to completely rebuild our public transportation system and integrate electric vehicles into the economy. Energy efficiency, transmission line improvements, renewable heat through heat pumps, large-scale wind and solar with battery storage can power New York State completely now. It is a question of political will. It is not a question of technological capacity. Now more than ever, we need the Public Service Commission to rise to the urgent occasion, hold utility companies accountable, and truly lead New York State into our green energy future. So that means, one, stop promoting and incentivizing dirty fracked gas immediately. Two, facilitate the creation of thousands of green jobs. Green jobs are created 80-1 for fossil fuel jobs at this point in weatherization, energy efficiency, infrastructure improvements, and renewable generation sector by funding the alternatives to fossil fuel heat and electricity, like was done in Westchester after the gas moratorium. Three, fine, penalize, sue, and censure investor-owned utilities and fossil fuel companies for poisoning our communities and poisoning the marketplace of ideas as they continue to cynically market methane-emitting fracked gas as a renewable bridge fuel. It is not a renewable bridge fuel. And four, stop delaying on the energy efficiency proceeding and make NYSERDA continue its current heat pump incentives through 2020. And honestly, five, the Article 10 siting process, which is the permitting process for all large-scale renewable generation, it has tens and tens and tens of solar and wind farms locked up in that process right now. The only thing that seems to make it through that process is fracked gas power plants. That to me means there's something wrong with the process as it is. Public Service Commission, it's in your hands, and we are going to push you to do it whether you like it or not.
How did the governor respond to this situation? Here are several excerpts from his recent letter. Quote, "The moratorium is either a fabricated device or a lack of competence. There is no legitimate need for it in the first place. There are existing short-term options to contract for non-piped gas from other sources, which National Grid either deliberately, negligently, or incompetently did not secure. National Grid should have explored all options before denying service. Gas can be trucked, shipped, or barged, and other infrastructure could be proposed or additional unloading facilities installed. Electric service and demand response measures could be proposed. Heat pumps and renewable sources could be proposed. these options should have been explored and weighed by National Grid and made public for consumers to evaluate before National Grid denied gas service. In a later paragraph, the lack of National Grid's capacity in addressing the supply and demand issue was actually exacerbated by National Grid's own actions. National Grid marketed, quote, oil-to-gas conversions, end quote, which increased the gas demand and the customer base of National Grid in reckless disregard of the company's failure to have any future plan to meet the demand it was creating. And then one last later paragraph. There are only two theories to explain National Grid's actions. Either National Grid was grossly negligent in relying exclusively on the speculative construction of a private pipeline to meet the demands that it was statutorily required to provide, or National Grid deliberately defrauded the people of the state by not developing or pursuing existing supply options to force approval and reliance on a private pipeline to further their business interests at the cost of the consumer. So where are we at now, heading into the next PSC meeting on November 14th, this Thursday? Will the governor and PSC come up with a plan to get the state off of fossil fuels and onto renewable energy? If so, when? And will it be in time to help avert the greatest crisis that humanity has ever faced? Stay tuned as these issues develop. I'm Dave Pablo for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
And thank you, Dave, for that informative piece. Stay tuned to WOOC 105.3 FM for continued coverage of these events.
Joe Lombardo, co-chair of the United Anti-War Coalition, discussed the upcoming United Nations meeting on the 39 countries that the U.S. is sanctioning and the military coup in Bolivia. This is by Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're talking with Joe Lombardo, who's one of the co-chairs of the United National Anti-War Coalition. We want to talk to Joe about a couple issues. One about the military coup taking place in Bolivia at the moment. But also this Thursday or this week, the United Nations is going to be holding, some type of convening around the issue that United States seems to really like to sanction different countries. So Joe, can you explain to the listeners, what is United Nations doing with respect to the issue of sanctions?
Well, there was a meeting about a month ago that took place with 88 countries involved that are kind of reconstituting themselves as the non-aligned nations. There had been a group of non-aligned nations when the two superpowers, Soviet Union and United States, were there, and these were groups of nations that did not fall into the orbit of either. But there are 88 nations, and they say 88 plus one because China has joined them. They are going to have a meeting at the UN and to discuss sanctions. The United States has unilateral sanctions against 39 countries that is causing tremendous damage and death in these countries, and they believe that it's illegal and should be stopped.
So, you know, what's the highest total, like the second highest country in terms of the number of, sanctions they're imposing on other countries? Is the United States, way out of line compared to any of the other country?
Pretty much the United States has imposed unilateral sanctions. They've been joined by other countries who will support those sanctions. But also they sometimes, when they want to seriously sanction a country, demand of all other countries that if they don't go along with the sanctions and they continue to trade with these countries, they themselves will not be allowed to trade with the United States. And so even if they're opposed to the sanctions, the United States is such a big market they have to support the sanctions against Cuba or Venezuela, for instance.
Well, you mentioned, Cuba and Venezuela. Probably most listeners are aware, somewhat of an antagonism between the United States and those countries. But you mentioned there are dozens of other countries. What are some of the other countries and why are we sanctioning them?
Well, pretty much we use sanctions as a form of warfare against countries that we, the United States and the State Department, doesn't like, United States government. So North Korea is sanctioned, Russia is sanctioned, China is sanctioned, then Bolivia was sanctioned. Of course, Bolivia might change because of this coup that's going on. Nicaragua is sanctioned. Many, many countries, is 39 in all. Zimbabwe has some kind of sanctions. Syria, of course, and others.
So what can the United Nations actually do other than, you know, maybe wave their finger at the you know, Trump and the United States? But does the United Nations have any power to roll back any of these sanctions?
Well, the United States, United Nations, I believe, has pretty much gone along with what the United States wanted. There's often been votes. So recently there was a vote against the blockade against Cuba, with very severe sanctions that we have against Cuba. Every country in the world except for the United States and Israel voted that these sanctions are wrong. So in many cases, it's just a political repudiation of the United States policy, and they can't really do very much. Of course, if the Security Council decides to do something, more can happen. However, the United States has vetoed many, many times moves in the Security Council to condemn sanctions or to condemn policies of Israel or other things that the United States doesn't want to see happen. So a lot of it is just a political statement, but there is some power, but with the United Nations, but they haven't really used that in any force against the illegal sanctions that the United States has done in the past. This meeting on the 14th, this Thursday, is an attempt to start some kind of campaign within the UN to oppose the sanctions that might have some teeth. Whether or not that's going to happen or not, I don't know.
Now, you know, the big foreign policy news in the last day or so has been that Morales, the elected president of Bolivia, had decided or agreed to step down after tremendous pressure from the military and other right-wing forces, and he had actually agreed earlier in the day, apparently, to hold new elections. What exactly is going on in Bolivia?
Well, Morales is pretty popular. His economy under Morales, and he's one of the countries that has been sanctioned, despite the sanctions, has been growing at the greatest rate of any country in Latin America for the past several years. He has taken the poverty rate and halved it. So it's half of what it was before. And he's created great benefits for the poor people and the indigenous population, which is a very large percentage of the population in Bolivia. And he himself is the first indigenous president. But the United States, as with Venezuela and other countries, typically does not like to see the wealth of country and the resources of the country go back to the people, because it denies the U.S. corporations and Wall Street to take some of that wealth as investments and use it to make themselves richer. So the United States has always opposed these kind of moves. So the United States has been opposed to Morales all along. Marco Rubio has been recently tweeting a lot right before the last round of elections. He says, we can't assume these elections are going to be fair. Something else has to happen. So he kind of knew this was going on. And Morales has been warning against a coup for the last several months. But the elections did happen. And according to their electoral policy, if one party, the leading party, the party that gets the most votes, gets 10% more than the party who gets the second most votes, there does not have to be a runoff election. And he got more than 10%. And so there was not a runoff election. So the opposition cried foul and said that, no, we don't believe that. We think there was some irregularities with the elections. The United States said, yeah, we think there were some irregularities with the election. And so did the Organization of American States, which is very highly influenced by the United States because the United States pays 60% of their budget. However, none of them gave a single piece of evidence to show this. They just didn't like the fact that Morales is popular and won. And so there's some very violent demonstrations. People were killed. Homes of people that supported Morales were burnt down. Families were attacked. A mayor that supported Morales was dragged out and beaten and her hair cut off. Very, very violent things. And the police and the military first said, well, we're not going to intervene. And then finally they said, we think Morales needs to step down. And that basically was a military coup. And it was clear that they were giving in to the wishes of the United States. And probably it was money that exchanged hands. And the whole opposition was helped by Alliance for Democracy and USAID and other NGOs that typically intervene into the affairs of other countries around the world, U.S. NGOs. So he had to step down. It was in great danger. He's now in hiding. Many of the Latin American countries have come out and opposed the coup. Mexico and some other countries have said they will give him asylum. But what is not being reported now is that there's a huge opposition to this coup that's being developed in an indigenous city of 1 million people just south of La Paz, the capital. They've started setting up barricades. They are arming themselves. They intend to take their country back. And so what will happen, I don't know. The person who decided to become president when Morales stepped down was an opposition figure from the Senate. She just declared herself president, very much like what the person in Venezuela did, this Guaido guy. They declare themselves president, and the U.S. endorses them and then says that's the legitimate president.
Joe, we're out of time. We've been talking with Joe Lombardo from the United National Anti-War Coalition.
And thank you, Joe Lombardo, for that piece. And he was speaking with Mark Dunley of the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine is a program you can listen to online and learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media. That's our home. Check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in from 7 till 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. Now, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network, their roaming correspondent, Willie Terry, attended a Hudson Valley Community College Cultural Affairs event, on November 7th, with a performance by the Piscataway Nation singers and dancers from Port Tobacco, Maryland. In this segment, you will hear music from their performance as his interview with Native American Mark Tyack.
Yeah. This is Willie Terry, a Roman labor correspondent, and I'm here at the Hudson Valley Community College, where they're celebrating Native American History Month. And they have a group called the Piscataway National Singers and Dancers. That's a group that regularly perform at the Museum of American Indian in Washington, D.C. And they also perform at major Native American festivals throughout the United States. So being it Native American History Month, I'm going to try to get a few comments from one of the representatives. I didn't catch your name when you were saying.
Mark Tyack.
Mark Tyack. And you're, Tyack. You're Tyler in the group is?
I'm just a regular grassroots Indian young man. Oh. No, but our family's last name, Tyack, means chief. Mm-hmm. My father, he's the present-day chief of our tribe. Mm-hmm. And when he passes away, then I'll become the 29th generation of hereditary chiefs.
And does he wear a different...
He has a chief's bonnet.
And is that like
yeah, the bonnet.
Legacy?
Yeah, yeah, he has a bonnet.
And were you guys put on a reservation at one point?
We have, where we live at, we do not have a reservation. We have a community.
Where's that?
In Port Tobacco, Maryland. Now, our family, we're from the principal capital village that's known as Mayon. Mayon was also our seat of government. Like Washington, D.C., the seat of government of the United States, Mayon was our seat of government of our territory. Mayon is directly across from Mount Vernon, Virginia. It still has signs everywhere down there, Mayon Reserve. It was set up as a reservation for our people, but that land was illegally taken away from us.
What's the significance that American Indians celebrate Native American History Month during this time? What's the significance of this particular
time? Well, this is the month that it was declared.
Oh, but just declared.
Yeah, it was just declared. Uh-huh. Just like African American History History Month. That's in February. That's just the month that it was declared. Hey, man, every day is American Indian Day to us because it lives in our hearts, our families, and in our lives, you know.
Yeah, I just have one question that I want to ask you. In reference to, we have a Native American history course here at the school.
Yes.
Right. Now, do you think that the country is doing enough to, like, put out information about Native American history, you know, into the school system? Do they need to be more?
I think that it's a step. But the step is a very small step, okay? Until the truth is being told from our perspective, it's just a small step. Because you got to keep in mind the books that are being used that was written about American Indians, those books are so outdated, so inaccurate, you know. Many things in historical books will tell you that American Indians, we came across the Bering Strait during the time of Ice Age, and there was three different migrations. For us, we have what we call creation stories, and our creation stories tell us that we began here, that we originated here. This is where the Creator placed us. So when you listen to people that are archaeologists, and no offense to somebody who's an archaeologist or an anthropologist, they're going to tell you, in my expert opinion, my theory. That's not historical fact. That's an opinion and a theory. Just like I can come up with a lot of opinions on other people and theories. But we have to look at historical facts.
So the history really have to be rewritten.
It does.
It have to be rewritten.
It does. You know, it does. It began because much of the history where things were being recorded, it started with Columbus. Columbus was also the father of slavery.
Right.
And until we can recognize that, you know, where the genocide actually began at, and when we recognize it, that's the first step of building a bridge and healing that we all, you know, have to live here collectively together. So is enough being done? Well, not really. Not really, you know.
So what would, let's just one question, what is the major points or theme that you try to bring out today?
Well, what we try to bring out today is to share the beauty of Native culture. Break down some of those stereotypes, you know. You'll be surprised that in today's society in 2019 that how many people think that Indians still ride horses, live in teepees, and live on reservations. You know, teepees was only a small part of historical tribal traditional homes. Not all of us lived in teepees. We lived in what was called longhouses. And through programs like this, educating the general public, we're able to share the beauty, but we're also able to form friendships too.
And before you y'all came here, someone came and talked about boarding schools.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they gave us...
That's a very sensitive issue, you know, mm-hmm. when you start talking about how Native children were being illegally stolen from their homes, from their families, and sent to boarding schools. And many of these boarding schools were hundreds and thousands of miles away. It was a policy at that time for the boarding schools. They had a policy and a quote that went along with it. Kill the Indian, save the man. And what that was is not like physically kill the Indian, but to assimilate the Indian and make him a man now. You know, God made the four races of mankind. There's the for the Native people, for the Asian people, for the European people, for the African people. And we are all humans. We are all men. And we all have our own ways.
And I think you kind of mentioned that, too, when you said that you couldn't speak your language.
Yes.
They tried to take away
yes.
your culture and everything.
Yes.
Right? But yes. anyway, thank you.
And that was Willie Terry reporting from the Hudson Valley Community College Cultural Affairs event that took place on November 7th. That was the speaker you heard was Native American Mark Tayak with the Piscataway Singers and Dancers.
Next, we have Justin Baker, and this week he is talking with Julie Torres of Lab Space. Well, if you don't know Lab Space, it's a contemporary art gallery located in Hillsdale, New York. It's run by Julie and her partner, Alan Lechter. In my opinion, well, certainly in Justin's opinion, it's showing some of the most challenging and exciting work in the area. The current show in Hillsdale, which features 10 artists that live and work in the area, and it's up and running until December 1st. So take it away, Justin.
Hey, this is ColorWorks Radio, and I'm your host, Justin Baker. With me this week is Julie Torres of Lab Space. If you don't know, Lab Space is a contemporary art gallery located in Hillsdale, New York, that is run by Julie and her partner, Ellen Letcher. And in my opinion, it's showing some of the most challenging and exciting work in the area. Their current show, Hillsdale, which features 10 artists that live and work in Hillsdale, New York, is up and running till December 1st. So go check it out and listen up. Very professional. All right, well, this week I am in Hillsdale, right? Yeah, okay, that's where I am. Yeah. and it's beautiful here. And I am with Julie Torres of Lab Space. Hi, Julie.
Hey, thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me. So the name of your gallery is Lab Space. It's in Hillsdale. What is actually the name of the current show that we're sitting in?
The name of the show is Hillsdale. And it's actually an exhibition of all Hillsdale artists. It's 10 artists who live right around here.
Okay. Oh, that's fascinating. Extremely talented Hillsdale. I wanted to come down because I follow you on Instagram, and then for a moment I was confused about who was running the space, but I was corrected. So how long have you been the current, you know, formation of Lab Space?
Ellen Letcher and I took the space on from Susan Jennings in April of 2018. So, oh no, that's not right. I think it's April 2017. Okay. So that, no, that's right. April 2018. Okay. My math is not so good. April 2018, which means in this April, which is actually 2020, it'll be 2 years. So a little over, so almost 2 years now.
Okay. What made you want to take over Lab Space, or even if, what's your background in contemporary art?
Well, Ellen had a great space. It was actually the first gallery in Ridgewood, I believe, on the border of Bushwick, called Famous Accountants. We met there, and yeah, it was a really formative space for me as an art viewer and as a budding organizer, curator, and now gallerist, which actually I didn't see coming at all. I had been an independent curator doing sort of more DIY projects, mostly in Bushwick, but sort of around the New York scene. That started out in 2012, and that's when I met Ellen. That's when she had Famous Accountants, which ran for 2 years. And we both met Susan Jennings at Artist Run, which was a DIY artist run anti-fair that happened in conjunction with Satellite Art Show in Miami. Okay. And I think that was 2016 or 2015.
Okay.
So she was there doing a project called Made with Janice Caswell and Katarina Wong. And Ellen and I were there doing Art in America. It was a show of an artist from every state. And we bonded with SJ immediately and realized that we had sort of a similar idea about curating, collaborating, making art ourselves, and how they're all sort of connected. And that's something that Ellen and I bonded on when we first met. So I didn't expect, honestly, to ever see SJ again. And we had no plans to move to the Hudson Valley. We were living in Bushwick. So fast forward about a year later, we found ourselves living in Hudson with artist and musician Claudia Tienen. We moved up here with Claudia in 2016, September. And SJ reached out to us and said, oh, I hear you're in Hudson. You should come to Lab Space. So we came to Lab Space, and we wound up collaborating with SJ on a show called Taconic North. It was all local artists. It was amazing. It was about 150, I think, artists. So much fun. Actually, that's where I met Matt Tiernan,
okay,
who we mentioned earlier. Well, who we talked about earlier.
Sure.
And I don't know how many months later, SJ decided to pivot to some other things. Mm-hmm. And she texted me out of the blue, would you two be interested in taking on the gallery? I think I thought about it for 5 minutes. Okay. And then I wrote back, yeah, we'll take it.
Okay, cool. Well, that's fascinating. That's a long, kind of meandering way to get, not your story, but it's interesting how far the connections went back.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you were in Brooklyn, involved in the art scene. I don't want to go too far back, but do you have a degree in art history, or is your do you have an academic foundation in it? Or I'm just kind of curious about that.
I am an art school dropout, okay, which Kathy Bradford told me never to say, but I say it anyway because it's true. And I think there's many of us out there. I went to SVA for one semester. It was too expensive. I didn't want the loans. And, you know, as a bratty 19-year-old, I didn't feel like I was getting anything out of it. So I quit. And then I didn't figure out how to be an artist for about 20 years after that. And then, this is really funny, but when I started going to like Bushwick shows and open, it was really Bushwick Open Studios that was like a pivotal thing for me personally. Ellen has an art degree. And, you know, she studied photography and she's the academic one. So when we met, I was just discovering so many artists, peers, people doing things that were, that I could really relate to. It was the first time, really. And it was sort of what taught me how to be an artist and how to curate. I went to Norte Mar, which was Jason Andrews' apartment gallery in his home. And that was like a revelation because I realized that you just need your living room. You can actually just put a show up in your living room and invite all the artists and it's a show. So that was just like a really formative time for both of us, really, in Bushwick those years. I mean, for her earlier, maybe starting in 2009, and in me starting more like 2010 to 2012.
What did you go to SVA to study?
This is really weird, but I walked into SVA and I said I wanted to be a fine arts major, and they said, no, we think that you should be a media arts major because when you get out, you're going to need to get a job. And it after 20 minutes of arguing with them, and this still haunts me, I let them change my major to media arts. And they convinced me to do it by saying, well, your first year, it'll all be the same classes anyway. And then if you really want to switch back to fine arts, you can. But so much of, I mean, I hate to say this because SVA is like a great school and I'm sure it was great for other people. But for some reason for me, I just, it wasn't a good fit and I didn't click with it at all. No. Yeah. But I did make like one really great art friend, my friend Stephanie, like, it was a good experience in other ways, but it's just for me, it didn't turn out to be my formative art experience.
That's kind of fascinating. Are you from New York area? Is that like where your home base or did you move there?
I was born in the Bronx, raised mostly in White Plains. I went to high school in Yorktown Heights. So actually this area, the Hudson Valley, is really the hometown for me. So it's been really fun to sort of come back and be in this environment again. I realized at the age of 40 something I'm not actually a city girl. I thought I was. I really have been enjoying my time here in the Hudson Valley, and it just feels, I think for both of us, Ellen and I, it feels like a really good fit. Also, it feels a little bit like Old Bushwick in the way that you can do almost anything. You can organize things easily. There's a great community and connecting with other artists and gallerists and organizers. So there's that like camaraderie, I guess, that sort of maybe has been dying out a little bit in the city because it's just so expensive now and so many people are pushed out to other areas, or so many people have left. So we are feeling that really strong here, which is why we love to do these huge shows of artists in the area.
Thank you for listening. As always, go check out Colorworks Gallery at 621 River Street in Troy, New York. Up now is Unseen, a group show that features work about what we do not see, the invisible, the hidden, and the overlooked.
And that was Justin Baker of Colorworks Radio. You just heard him speaking with Julie Torres of Lab Space, a art gallery located in Hillsdale, New York, and that exhibition is running until December 1st.
Well, Schenectady Today host Ann Perillo discusses the Albany Civic Theater production, Alabama Story, with director Barbara Davis Dickman and actors Lucy Breyer, Rich Cross, and Marquis Health.
Well, I have the crew, or some of the crew, from the Albany Civic Theater, and they're doing Alabama Story. It has to do with civil rights. It has to do with a librarian. So I'm going to ask Barbara Dick, who is the Barbara Davis is the director. I was trying to say director and Barbara at the same time, and it came out wrong. Barbara Davis is the director. Along with her, she's brought Rich Cross, Lucy Breyer, and Marquise. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
You're listening to us. This is Schenectady Capital Region Today, and you're listening to us at WOOC-FM. And we're going to be talking about the play coming up, and it will be shown November 1st through the 17th in Albany. So, Barbara, let's take a look at the play. And how does the librarian and civil rights and rabbits all come together?
Well, it actually is based on an actual event that happened in Alabama in 1959, 60 years ago. There was a librarian who, among other books that she ordered or selected for the
library.
Would this
be Lucy
behind
you?
That would be Lucy.
Lucy Breyer is, Lucy Breyer is with us, and she is the librarian.
And she chose a number of books from the American Library Association's list of recommended books, and one of them was called The Rabbit's Wedding, which tells the story of two rabbits who get married. And one of the rabbits is a black rabbit, and one of the rabbits is a white rabbit, which led this gentleman's character to, and
that's
a number of other
Rich
people
Cross
in Alabama.
Rich Cross is sitting next to you, yeah.
A number of other people in Alabama to feel that it was encouraging integration and promoting that to our youth, our young children.
And Rich is playing senator, so of course you got to be a big Southern gentleman
yes,
here, right?
Yes, yeah.
So Richard Cross, tell us a little bit about your character.
Okay, he is, the name was changed to protect the family, the descendants of the family, but he's a real person who, there are some people who are conservative, he's a reactionary. He actually...
he's beyond this.
Beyond this. He promoted the, basically the deportation of African Americans out of Alabama during the 1950s.
Are you kidding?
He wanted them to move out of the state.
I had no clue of that.
So when this came, along, he was the head of the state legislature committee that did the library funding.
That didn't happen, of course.
No. But he did try to get this book pulled from.
I mean, he's the segregationist. Beyond all
right,
segregation.
Right. They say that he was even beyond George Wallace and some of
oh,
the other.
Oh, really?
So that's how...
I didn't know anyone could get... but that's my little excuse me while I digress.
So he tried to get the book pulled. He tried to get the librarian fired. He tried everything he could to basically suppress this book. Not just this book, but other books, because it turned out on this list was also Martin Luther King's book, Stride Toward Freedom, which...
Probably even Mockingbird, you know. I mean, there's so many books that were banned at that.
That is mentioned right. later on.
Yeah, it is.
He went after that, too.
So I guess this is an interesting, what city?
Montgomery. It takes
it
place
was in Montgomery.
It takes place in Montgomery.
Yeah.
My character and Marcus's character are actually from Demopolis, which is another city right down in the middle of Alabama, but the actual action takes place in the state capital. So.
Yeah. I've been in Birmingham, and I have to say they have a fabulous park there that really goes into the segregation that and the all the terrible things that went on with the bombing of the church and things like that. Marquise, how did you feel about playing in this, and what is your part?
I feel great. I'm excited about the play.
Well, you're excited about every part he's in. He's such a great actor.
So I play Joshua Moore, and he is an activist, and he lives in Detroit, but...
So he came down to straighten him out.
Yeah. So he came down back to Alabama because he does volunteer work at the Martin Luther King's Church, and on his, you know, during his time down there, he meets his old childhood friend, Lily Whitfield, and they kind of like reflect back on their childhood and bad things that happened to him, and he's feeling real uncomfortable about certain situations that happened.
But he is trying to dissuade the senator from his... In a way.
Actually, well, all this is going on at the same time.
Oh, at the same time.
Yeah, so he's, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Because we don't communicate.
A play with it. Okay, yeah. Lucy, you are the librarian.
I play the librarian, Emily
Lucy
Wheelock
Breyer, and we're talking about Alabama's Story that's going to be at the Albany Civic Theater, and they are be running from August, or August, where am I getting August? November 1st. I guess I want summer to come again. November 1st through the 17th.
You're not the only one.
Yeah.
You're not alone.
So, Lucy, tell me a little bit about your part. You're playing the librarian, and how did you feel about the part?
Oh, well, it's... this character, she's heroic in some ways, in a very modest, librarian-y way. She's somebody who does not want the spotlight, does not want to be, does not like the glare of publicity, but she feels very strongly about her job being to protect the books and to make the books available to the public. And so when the senator threatens to burn the book, she
oh my,
is,
book burning! Oh yes. My, it's back in Germany, I mean, in the 1930s.
Yeah, it's a book of it's a story about censorship, and it's a story about people's resistance to that censorship. And the Lily Joshua story is kind of going on in parallel at the same time.
Okay,
but we really don't intersect with the library story. They're connections, but. We never play a scene together.
Yeah, no.
because you're telling different stories.
We're telling different stories.
Parallel stories.
But they parallel.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating to play an actual historic character, even though not everything in the play is absolute for truth.
Well,
the story
they take a little poetic license here when they write. Because you want to make it a little flashier
here and
there to do that. Now, I guess, Barbara, you probably know this. Are any of the characters still alive that were involved?
I don't believe so. Okay. Emily died in, 2000? No. 2001, I believe she died at 89. And she had just received an award from the American Library Association just prior to her death.
Yeah.
And
my character died in 1984.
Yes. Yeah. So those
so
are
they're not here to condemn the play.
No, but the playwright does change the name of Senator Higgins' character just to spare his family any.
But I'm sure that we could Google that. We can Google everything.
Well, I can tell you the name. His real name was E.O. Adkins Jr., which was he was the son of a Confederate War veteran.
And oh, so he was entrenched
he
in the,
was,
in the
yeah,
separation.
The son of a son of the Confederacy.
Yeah,
so,
oh my
yeah.
God.
So, yes.
Well, you know, this is something that we all have to remember, and it's good. I mean, we're talking about this play, Alabama's Story, about the Civil Rights. The next play we're going to be talking about is The Diary of Anne Frank, which, of course, is another historic, real thing that happened. And I think by bringing this forward, we're getting a new generation to understand what happened, because it's easy to read about it in a book, and you know, it's okay, so I read about it, but to actually see it acted and to see the interaction about on stage, so we want to encourage teenagers to come and see this as well.
Absolutely.
Yes. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Everybody.
It's a very thought-provoking play.
Yeah. Thought-provoking.
Very important.
You're listening to WOOC-FM, and I'm here at Open Stage Media in Proctor's, and we're filming right now, Schenectady Capital Region Today. I want to thank you all for being here, and please check out the play. It's from November 1st through the 17th.
And that was Schenectady Today host Ann Perillo discussing the Albany Civic Theater's production of Alabama Story with members of the crew. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe, and our thanks to our engineer tonight, Sophia Cahill-Lane. We invite you to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
And don't forget, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with us, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by our production meeting. It's held on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.